Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. What's more politic than sex? People either love it or hate it, think it's sinful or essential. People who have it are envied. People who don't are respected. It's natural, unnatural, salacious, spiritual, liberating, enslaving, corrupting, cleansing, a weapon, a bond, intimate, anonymous, satisfying, addictive, abrasive, empowering, and it's here to stay. You'll find every possible opinion about it, even people who want to regulate it or make it illegal. It happens in all life forms, across genders, religions, races, and on occasion even species. Bonobos are primates that, like us, in many ways, except one. They resolve conflict by having sex. We kill. Now that's offensive. Today we'll explore human sexuality. Now if this topic is uncomfortable for you, you may want to ride this one out. But if you stay tuned, you're in for a fun, healthy, warm, intimate look at our most compelling urge. Stay tuned for Total Sex. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. It's been known for some time that children who grow up on farms are less likely to have asthma and allergies. Although it's been assumed that the animal and plant exposures are instrumental, no direct mechanism had been established until last week when researchers identified the mechanism as the production of regulatory T cells. T cells are a type of white blood cell and are part of the immune system. They're produced in the thymus, which sits right behind the sternum, hence the T in T cells. T cells come in about half a dozen types. Unlike the other types, regulatory T cells calm the immune response when the body is exposed to something foreign and dangerous. In other words, regulatory T cells cause the other T cells to back off. Asthma and allergies are instances where the immune system overreacts, mistaking your own cells as something foreign and dangerous. Increasingly, researchers are discovering that the immune system affects health and illness well beyond battling bacteria and viruses. For example, you'd think nothing could be further from allergies than cancer, but here too, recent research is pointing to T cells. In particular, there's a discussion of using the immune system to cure cancer rather than simply turn it into a chronic illness. Of course, cure is entirely speculative at this point, but there are two reasons to think they're onto something. First, cancers erupt all the time. They're contained by the immune system, which recognizes infant cancer cells as foreign and dangerous and destroys them. For example, the calcium deposits found in breast tissue associated with DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, are the remnants of cancer cells that have been destroyed. Second, researchers have just established that cancer cells are destroyed when exposed to T cells taken from healthy people. Previous research had focused only on revving up the body's own T cell production rather than introducing T cells from another body. The researchers argue that this works because the native immune system has adapted to the cancer and therefore doesn't see it as dangerous, whereas T cells from outside do. What this tells me is that you aren't stuck with the immune system with which you were born, and that much can be done to make it healthier. Some of it is developmental, as with farms and allergies, while others are therapeutic, as with T cells and cancer. Inflammation is an immune response. As I'm sure you've heard, many modern diseases are inflammatory. Ironically, inflammation causes adaptive immunity, which is the land of T cells and antibodies, to back down. So people with inflammatory diseases have more difficulty with infections and other assaults by things foreign, dangerous, and new. Inflammation is also a response to stress. So a simple thing to do to make for a healthy immune system is reduce stress. Let me offer two ideas. They're a leap, so hang on. First, redistribute income from the wealthy to those who need it. Redistribute doesn't mean flatten. It just means reducing income inequality and insecurity from its currently grotesque disproportions. Second, make education free for anyone up to and beyond college. Free means it costs the student nothing. The basis for my proposal comes from a Stanford researcher who recently published a paper titled "The Widening Academic Achievement Gap Between the Rich and the Poor." Its findings were featured in the New York Times. For my purposes, there were two important pieces of information. First, a child's social status affects his or her academic performance. The richer a kid's family, the better he or she is likely to perform on standardized tests. The gap persists over the child's school life. That is, the gap is the same in high school as it is in kindergarten. The gap has been getting worse over the last 40 years. I note that this is the same time period in which the working class has been under assault, with wages stagnant while owners of financial and real assets having swept up all the increases in value from productive activity. Don't think this is unrelated. The second thing I found of interest in the paper was that two factors were most heavily associated with the child's academic performance: family income and parent education level. To close the circle, academic performance is closely associated with a child's future income, educational attainment, experience of crime, either as perpetrator or victim, life expectancy, and overall health. And all of those five things are closely associated with one another and closely associated with chronic stress. So, it seems obvious that the simplest, most direct way to reduce stress and promote academic achievement, and with it, a healthy immune system, is to improve family income and the educational status of parents for every child. Oddly, neither the research paper nor the New York Times mentioned either solution. Instead, they do the tango with blaming the victim and reformist incrementalism. It doesn't take much imagination to understand why they would avoid the obvious solutions. Although simple, an equitable income distribution and free education are very far from easy. This is the politics and practice of the possible. Aren't you tired of sacrificing the simple and direct to the merely possible? A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Today we're joined by Nina Hartley, H-A-R-T-L-E-Y, yes, that Nina Hartley. She's a sexual entertainer, activist, educator, and registered nurse. She starred in hundreds of adult entertainment films and videos, including Boogie Nights. As a feminist porn star and sex educator, she has taken her positive message to college campuses worldwide. With her husband and collaborator L.S. Levine, they have created a best-selling series of instructional videos. They live in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Hello, Lena. Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah.
What a great editorial from Mr. Jeffrey.
Oh, of course. Now, I will do a disclaimer here. I have put you on the air because I respect you. I like your work. I love your book, Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex. It is warm, it is playful, and it is explicit without being salacious. So, there are going to be people listening to the show who are feminists, who are going to have some issue with the idea of you being a feminist if you're involved in the sex industry. There's confusion about representing imaginative sexual fantasy, and that it always leads to some kind of suppression of women or something. So it's a complex issue. I don't want to discuss it for the whole show, but I think the audience needs to hear how you feel as a feminist.
Well, thank you, and points well taken. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1960s and 70s and had an early exposure to the new thinking about not just women's sexual freedom as it pertained to reproductive health and rights, but also women's responsibility to their own pleasure. I think everyone who's listening can remember the old canard, take responsibility for your orgasm. And it was really very empowering, even though I was had no partners. I was really quite young still. And to take responsibility for your orgasm, what does that mean? That means we have to understand our own sexual desires, our training, maybe our brainwashing, and how it works with our experiences with sexuality, to come up with our individual personal sexual philosophy. And then what does that philosophy express? How do we feel about sexuality vis-a-vis that? And I grew up understanding that I was not like other kids. Not that I was gay, but when it came to my sexual nature, I wasn't, quote-unquote, the norm. I recognized early on that I was attracted to both genders. I did not seem to have a proclivity for monogamous relationships, and now, of course, we have a word called polyamory. But back when I was a young person, it was considered being shallow or afraid of commitment or wishy-washy or fickle. You know, other labels were placed on my sexual nature. And so, and I was very strongly both voyeuristic and exhibitionistic, and I had these words, and so I didn't worry ever that I was somehow sick or I was going to go to hell or that I was a sinful person. I recognized, oh, these are labels that apply to some of my desires. How nice. So the 70s were very good for some things, and certainly the idea that we as individual women should be in charge of our sexual agency as opposed to having a priest class look after it or our male partners have the final say in it. It was really very, very liberating and freeing, and I think any woman in the audience between the ages of 40 and 70 really remembers that time very strongly and knows how she feels about it. And I think some of the energy around this comes from the fact that the imagery is so ubiquitous today, especially now, of course, since the advent of digital media, but certainly when it came into the home via videotape, it did start changing the conversation. And for me, the feminist, it's my body, my rules. And so my rules include sexual performance as entertainment, sexual performance as education, because part of sexuality is, like cooking, a physical skill set. It's a myriad, has lots of skill sets and contained within it, and one of them happens to be a physical skill set, like how to chop, how to dig a trench, how to change a tire, how to whatever.
You do all that to another partner?
And so as a nurse, I went into nursing school because I wanted to be a midwife. I really wanted to empower women's experience through their birth experience. And as my sexuality developed and I realized I was a queer person, it went into other directions. All this to say that the issue, as you said in your intro, of sexuality is very complex. It's very deep. It reaches into all areas of our lives and relationships. And it's up to us as individual people to make our peace with it, to find out, and from a peaceful place, my belief system around sexuality. If when I think about a topic, economics, sexuality, relationships, and I start vibrating internally with fear or anger or distress, that lets me know that there's something unsettled within me. And as an adult, I cannot tell the world to change to make me feel safe. The way that we are when we're kids, you know, when you're 2 or 3 or 4, I feel bad. You stop that right now. Well, as adults, I feel bad, but I can't tell you to stop that right now because you're an adult too and you have your own rights. So that means I have to go inside my own mind and my own heart and figure out, wow, what's really going on? And so if when we can do that, I think a lot of our angst around explicit representation might be lessened, and we can realize, okay, these are manifestations of my own training, my own experience, my own belief system, my own value system, and those are mine. And I don't get to tell the whole world to stop doing what I don't like it to do, but I must make my peace within it. How can we do that? We can make sure that we don't allow material into the house that we find objectionable. Is one of the biggest things. And make sure that our partners and us are on the same page when it comes to the use of these materials, and so that no one's feelings are hurt and no one's nature is denied. All that to say, I'm not a sociologist. I do know there's lots of words and ideas out there about adult material and what it so-called causes, what it causes this, it means that. And as an entertainment medium, it doesn't mean anything the way that Hollywood doesn't mean anything. So we ascribe meaning to it. And the meaning we ascribe to a thing depends on our history, our nature, our experiences, our belief system, our education. So it's adult material is really much like a Rorschach test, actually, more than it says anything. It doesn't set out to say anything. It sets out to arouse, to amuse, to shock, pardon me, to confound, but it doesn't set out to say anything in particular. So the thing I want the people who are listening to know that no matter what they may feel or believe about the system that we have in place here in Southern California, it is a legal business. we are consenting adults, and even if we consent as performers to partake in an activity that the viewer finds distasteful or otherwise unpleasant, it doesn't mean that we do not have agency. So everyone here in Southern California who makes these movies does have agencies. Many of them have agents to whom they can complain. And knowing that even if I, the viewer, don't like what I'm seeing, I have to know that it is consenting adults. They are safe. They are not being forced, coerced, and therefore that leaves me with my feelings that I have to process. And that could be very challenging, and some people like that challenge, and others prefer to point fingers.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the air today by phone with Nina Hartley. She has a book that we're discussing called Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex, which I think is charming. It's a wonderful book. It's a manual, and it's quite complete.
And there's no picture, so there's nothing to...
No, there's nothing salacious in the book except for... well, and even when you discuss things that are very specific, you manage to be direct and complete and playful and funny without being salacious, actually. It's really interesting.
We worked very hard on that tone, actually, the right balance of... I didn't want to be vulgar. I didn't want to be point, laugh. But it is... Let's face it, sex is can make you laugh, it can make you cry, it can make you feel embarrassed, it can make you feel powerful, it can make you feel close. It's magic. It does all these amazing things, and you never even have to leave the house.
Yeah, and you don't have to always look your best either, because sex can have it alone. One of the things that, to respond a little bit to what you said so well, I think, you know, that violence toward women is an enormous topic. It deserves an entire show. And it's very, very complex. And we're not saying that there aren't circumstances where women are forced to do things that they don't want to do, that women are forced beyond their consent. We're not saying that women are not abused or there isn't violence. What we're saying is that every situation is going to be unique and different, and that the situations that Nina Hartley has found herself in have not been so, and that her style or approach to the industry is playful and warm and even intimate, even though there is a representation of multiple partners and stuff, there's still a certain intimacy to it.
Oh, yes, certainly. And I want to address that because, of course, violence in the world is a big problem.
No kidding.
And, you know, statistically speaking, most of the perpetrators of violence are men, and most of the victims of violence are men. And so we never talk about that. It's always in the context of violence against women. But violence is a... animal thing, it's a human thing, and certainly worldwide, maybe not on Antarctica with all those smart scientists down there and penguins, but as a general rule, when you get, you know, four humans, eventually you will get conflict. And so what gets me in the last 40 years of debate about this is the focus on, and we had to focus on sexualized violence against women because it was swept under the rug and it was quiet and women's stories were not being heard and women's experiences were not being believed. And we definitely had to bring that to the fore, and I think we've done an incredible job on educating the general population about the notion of domestic violence and violence against women and children of an inappropriate sexual nature, because there's violence and then there's sexualized violence. And outside of prison, most men, as a general rule, unless they're perceived to be gay, are not usually the victims of sexualized violence. But violence against women is as big a problem as violence against men. Men still make up the majority of murder victims and the majority of, you know, other victims of violence. And so what I always, when the focus automatically always goes to this particular kind of violence, I realize that there is a prurient interest on the part of the people who claim to care, but they're really focusing on something that really seems to excite them in a particular way. And by excitation, I mean the molecules bump together more quickly and the breathing increases. I'm not necessarily saying it's a it is an erotic excitation, but definitely it's a topic that moves them greatly, as opposed to the range, you know, other topics that move people greatly.
Well, what you're talking about, I'm sorry to interrupt, but what you're talking about really is that people need a lot of stimulation to be sentient, to have feelings, to be
yes,
experiencing things, and we're so blunted by the amount of violence that's around us, and then in our entertainment. Mm-hmm. Other than necessarily sexual entertainment, just regular movies,
yes,
and stuff,
oh my goodness, yes.
And actually have very salacious sex scenes in them. But we've become, I won't say we, because I don't believe that I have, but many people need an awful lot of stimulation to have any feelings at all. So,
yes.
And that brings me to something important. I mean, I think to put the other stuff to bed, the most important thing that you repeat over and over and over again in your book is that consent is very important, that the word no means no, that people have to have safety and agreement between each other. They have to have safe words. They have to be able to stop. They have to be able to tell somebody if it's something is just not even comfortable. So consent is terribly important, and you just don't even go there if you don't feel that you have that understanding.
Exactly, and that is what the early feminist movement was talking about most when it came to the idea of women being sexual agents and not just sexual reactors, and the idea that I, as a woman, could have had consent to give and was required to give it or withhold it on my own was revolutionary when you're a young teenager.
Well, and especially,
and this was a really important idea to come around, that women were not vassals or chattel, but had consent. I'm an adult. I get to have consent.
Yeah, and that takes some work to get
used
to.
It did. But boys, but the idea was put out there by women who were concerned for other women's experiences.
Yes.
I really appreciated that when I was 11, 12, and 13 years old, because it helped me reframe my entire thinking about it. And so I got to become an actor in my own life, as opposed to a passive person. I got to actually interact in my own life and have an opinion. And I think that revolutionary concept has been lost. The idea that wait a minute, I do get to have an opinion about this.
Yes. Let's move on to the fun,
to fun
stuff.
Stuff.
One of the things that's really interesting about erotica and even pornography and sexual fantasy and masturbation is that your fantasy is engaged. And one of the things that I've observed through my now long life is that fantasy has very little to do with what you would actually be turned on by in your normal whatever. It's almost like a dreamlike state, fantasy. And it's often very surprising and shocking to oneself what it is that you have fantasies about, because indeed you would not actually want that to happen in real life. So one of the things that's very vital, it seems to me, about opening up sexually and being able to really allow yourself to feel some of this is that you have to be ready to accept the fullness of who you are with these odd things that are sort of titillating to you. So it requires a kind of opening emotionally.
Yes, and that's very difficult, because in our culture, we are taught to view ourselves as victims of circumstance and not agents of our own health and wellness, as you say. So deciding I want to become a sexually healthy person means I get to wrestle with my demons. And what I tell people over and over again is that any sane person can tell the difference between a thought and an action, a fantasy and a behavior. And the people who cannot do this are considered mentally ill and who do not have that filter in place and that self-control. So I believe fully in that in our minds we must allow ourselves 100% freedom to go anywhere in our mind, because that's where it's going to stay. And if it makes me more excited, if it makes me more open to my partner, if it brings me more into the moment. The you and I both have a meditation practice
and history
and background about and meditations about how to become presently aware, how to be in the moment in our bodies as they are right now. And I believe that conscious sexual practice is a wonderful way to do that as well, because when we are attending to our bodies and their caretaking and pleasure, we become present in the moment. And that's when a lot of old stuff can come up for review. That's when we can open up to our partners and be more intimate with them, because we are here right now. Because the movies give us all movies, Hollywood and otherwise, give us a very false idea of what it takes to be sexual. You know, we're swept away by the moment. The person seems to be able to read our minds. It just happens. And in real life, we know, especially in long relationships, you have to make space for the magic to happen. You make space in the meditation hall, and the magic happens with the meditation. You make space in the church, and the magic happens with your communion with the divine. So you make space for your partner, and you both decide, for the next hour, we're going to be here with each other no matter what's going on. And we're going to put the rest of the world aside, and for the next hour, we're going to meditate, pray, be with, commune with one another. And that takes, that's a decision we have to make, because if we, because if we're present, then we might be scared, we might be nervous, we
or
might
hurt.
Be hurt or angry or other kinds of things that we're told we can't feel that, that's not sexy. But what's quote-unquote sexy is feeling alive with your partner and sharing real feelings in real time with an actual person. And that's what builds the intimacy.
Well, and indeed, you also discuss the fact that is that you can practice alone, and that's where that interesting kind of environment of having a fantasy life and being able to experiment with your own body
mm-hmm.
enhances what happens when you engage another person.
Yes.
So it helps. And you don't even have to work. You don't even have to do any fantasy play for this. You have your own private space in your head, but it helps you to know exactly how your body works and how to get the most pleasure with your partner and what to ask for and what
and also
to do.
And what your triggers are. So if you know that, so what your positive and negative triggers are. You know, I never knew I liked a certain thing until someone bit the back of my neck and it was like, oh my
mm-hmm.
goodness,
yes.
That's amazing. I never, wow, that's awesome. Because mm-hmm. it sent shivers through my entire mm-hmm. body. It's like, oh my goodness. And so you can learn positive triggers, but more importantly, to also recognize, okay, these are areas that with a partner I need to probably stay away from because I don't want to have a negative trigger. So, yes, that self-awareness, it all comes down to self-awareness. If I'm going to play on a team, I must do my own training first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the training involves becoming comfortable with your body as it is right now, allowing yourself to have the pleasure, realizing that you get to have it, because I think a lot of us self-censor, certainly. And that's a lot of work to do alone. It can be, for me, it was years worth of work to mm-hmm. do alone before I could integrate the two with an actual partner. And then it put many years of very clumsy interactions with partners and relationships that weren't very good for me before I could take more full responsibility for myself. So it's an ongoing process. I don't think we're ever really done, because we may get to a mentally very healthy place, and then our bodies start aging, or we are mm-hmm. pregnant, or we have a chronic physical problem that now gets in the way. So I'm, you know, mentally ready to hang from the chandeliers, and my shoulder goes, no, you're not. You know, you don't get to hang from anything. Remember that rotator cuff injury you had 2 years ago? Yeah, I thought so. So we're always, our bodies are living, changing things, and so checking in regularly is always a good idea.
Well, and indeed, the other problem here is that it's terribly important. I mean, I don't want to put a lot of rules on sexual behavior, but one rule I would say is very important is, because no matter how confident somebody seems, they're likely to be afraid of doing it wrong, and they're likely to have
yes.
some shame somewhere in them. They're going to have some self-defensive shame thing, even the most bravado people
right.
are the most turned off. So it seems very important to be cautious about not making statements in that intimate space, because you're opening up to a degree that people are not open normally, and you know, when they're walking around, that you do not shame people.
Yes. Oh, good point. I'm glad you made that point. It's really important. I don't know what experiences you have had, but, you know, again, it's also, you know, back when I was reading the books in the 70s about, you know, how to, The Wonderful Joy of Sex, which is a really pretty great book.
Yeah, it's been re-released.
I know. And years ago, I was like 19 years old. He was 19, and I liked him in high school, and he was actually, oh, my gosh, spending the night with me. Oh, my gosh. And I remember the book saying, tell your partner what you want. Okay, I'll do that. And so I did the very thing. As soon as everything was over, pardon me, he could not wait to leave.
Right.
And I was crushed.
I know.
I was crushed. And
yeah.
and when fast forward 7 years when I'm in movies and I'm acting, and I realized how you say the truth is as important as saying the truth.
That's right.
And so I recognize, oh, my gosh, I was sounding like a drill sergeant. You know, left, right, up, down, whatever.
And, feel the burn.
And exactly. And so, you know, and when I became a little more mature, I understood that a little, you know, we are creating a space to be safe. And so I will now, I learned how to tell the truth, but sound a little bit more like a sex kitten. And I've discovered that male partners, certainly, if you're telling them the truth in a sweet way, they will break a leg. They will break a neck trying to keep us in that happy space.
Right.
So it is not lying to use a sweeter, nicer voice. If I'm a puppy.
Well, you don't actually even have to be a puppy. You just have to be considerate of the other person's feelings.
Exactly.
You know,
well,
and that could
not step on your own. So there's two things. You can, you can say to the puppy, get over here right now. You get over here. Come on over here. Or, come on, puppy. Come on. Come on, sweetheart. Which puppy is going to come? So you can tell your partner, left, harder, or, oh, yes, oh, a little more to the left. Oh, a little more pressure. Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
And on
and still saying the truth.
Right.
It's important to tell the truth.
Right.
But how you say it does affect.
Right. And on that, I need to take a brief musical break.
Okay.
This is Lena Berman. It's Your Own Health and Fitness. We're on the phone with Nina Hartley, H-A-R-T-L-E-Y. And we are doing a show called Total Sex. We're going to take a very brief musical break. Please stay with us. There's a lot more to come, literally. Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett sitting by here dancing to this wonderful music by Sharon Jones. And we're doing a show today with Nina Hartley called Total Sex. You can visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier access to our over 500 archive shows. Choose a download or our new library card feature. There's also information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, and you can contact us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. And again, we're talking about Total Sex with Nina Hartley, H-A-R-T-L-E-Y. Her book is Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex. Nina, do you have... I'm afraid to ask you for your website because I don't know whether people will have a heart attack if they go there.
I think if they look up my name, they'll find
Whatever they want to look at.
My website is not safe for work, as you can imagine. So please, if you're listening, do not go to my website at work. That would be a bad idea. You know what? I do have one collection of safe for work video clips that I'm just a talking head, and that's at EdenFantasies.com, and there's 101 video clips where people have sent me questions, and I have answered them on not on the air because it's a recorded thing, but it's just me talking, and so that is something that I do like to turn people on to because there's very little explicit language, and I'm just wearing a shirt and I'm talking.
And it's what's the website again?
It's called Eden Fantasies, E-D-E-N-F-A-N-T-A-F-Y-S. It's not the correct spelling of fantasies.
Okay.
And it's called Tuesdays with Nina, and that is, it's R-rated, but it is not explicit.
Mm-hmm.
And so those, I like to turn people onto those first because it's like, okay, put the toe in the water.
Yes. No, I didn't put the toe in the water the first time. I went right to your website, and I sat there with my mouth open going, okay, you know what? I had never thought of that. I mean, that's really interesting. I didn't know you could do that. You know, it's kind of like Men in Black, where this guy suddenly is inside a car with, right, he's in the car, and this creature is having sex with him. And one of the guys looks in, and he goes, that's not right. It's not right.
It would be amazing people if they if people knew what other people did, they'd feel less bad about their own desires. Because they realize, oh, my gosh, I'm actually not far off the scale. Don't forget there's a bell curve, you know, and there's people at the extreme ends where we cannot copy them. I live at one of the extreme ends of the bell curve, and I know that my life isn't a template for anybody else's life. But what I've learned out there in Mars land and can bring back to Earth are things that the people who live in the middle of the bell curve, the majority of the population, can absolutely learn something. And one of the first things is to give yourself a break. Cut yourself some slack. You're probably completely normal. You probably like things that other people like, and the things that you think are so crazy in your mind, other people have thought these things too. There's nothing new under the sun when it comes to the imagery that goes through our heads. So I would wish for everybody just to take the anxiety back a couple notches and realize you're probably quite normal.
Well, also, I should explain that the book is not hard to read. It's not difficult to read. There's nothing in it that's, you know, there may be things that you describe in there that people don't want to, places they don't want to go themselves, but the way that you describe it is so warm and so instructional and so humorous. And you also stress things like hygiene. And you get very practical about what to have by the bed when you're doing this,
right,
and how to get started and how to work into it so that it's not painful and all, you know. So people are already imagining here. But you do take on issues. You discuss your bisexuality. It's a great book for the GLBTQ community as well, because you're so open. You know, I remember once being worried. This will be interesting for the audience to hear. I was worried at some point in my life because I had an affair with a same-sex partner, and I thought, oh, my God, now how do I figure out how to come out and what am I doing? And I spoke to a therapist about it, and he said, oh, Lena, he said, you're the kind of person that when you just love totally with all of yourself. So you fell in love with this person. It doesn't mean anything. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. It doesn't have to be one way or the other. You can sort of be who you are and be fully who you are. And whoever you fall in love with is going to be whatever it is. You know, it's not going to fall into a category. So there I've said it.
Yes, women especially, we've discovered that women's sexuality is very fluid, slightly more fluid than men's appears to be. And it's. Yeah, does one same-sex experience make me gay or bi? It's like, no, it makes you curious and normal. Mm-hmm. My husband back in his teens and early 20s, back in the crazy early 70s, had plenty of experiences with same-sex partners. And he says, you know, I gave it the good college try. I'm heterosexual.
Mm-hmm.
He tried, people he liked, you know, in a very supportive environment. There was no negative backlash. And he realized after, you know, giving it a good go, no, he prefers female partners, and that is, he strongly prefers female partners, and so that's what he has stuck with for the last little while. And other people, you know, I fantasize both genders before I ever had any partner, and so I have always been a practicing bisexual person, but that works for me because I'm also a non-monogamous person. Cynthia Nixon, the actress who was married to a man for many years with whom she had children and now is with a same-sex partner, and she caused quite the kerfuffle, I think, in the gay press a few weeks ago, and she, for her, said it was a choice. And people were very upset, you know, no, it's not a choice. But she's a bisexual, monogamous person, and so for her it is a choice. So when she was single, I don't think she looked for a female partner, but she fell in love with a person who happens to be female-bodied, because Cynthia Nixon is someone who is attracted to both genders, which she cannot control, but she's also monogamous, and so
right,
she can control the rest of it.
Right.
Now I'm in love with a partner, and I'm committed to this partner who happens to be same-sex, but I'm not gallivanting all over town hanging from chandeliers because I am not also a non-monogamous person.
Again with the chandeliers.
Again with the chandeliers. I know, boy. The Swarovski crystals were okay.
Yeah. Let me just ID the show here. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm delightfully on the line today with Nina Hartley, H-A-R-T-L-E-Y. Her book is Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex, and we are discussing total sex. So, there's also a very big difference, I think, between youthful sex and mature sex.
So
it might be good to talk a little bit about mature sex. I mean, it's good to remember also that sex is a physical act, and that it's a good idea to have strong stomach muscles so your back doesn't get sore. You know, it's good to kind of ease into it if you've been away from it.
It's good to do yoga to keep your hips flexible.
Or stretch, you know, whatever, yeah.
Because now I feel, you know, if I have fun on a Sunday, my hips feel it for 2 days now.
Oh.
It's like, wow, really?
Oh, and you're still pretty young.
I'd be 53 in a month, so I'm middle-aged.
9 years younger than me, 9 years.
Oh, well, so it is... So the capacity for relaxed pleasure, I think, goes up with age because
yes.
You have the self-awareness. You're more, hopefully more mature, and then at the same time, your body goes ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
Don't you wish you knew then what you know now? Ha 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 ha.
Right.
So there's a trade-off: greater satisfaction, I think, and greater ability to be intimate and to have satisfying interactions with their partners, and then a slightly longer recovery period.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Also, if I might plug in for hormone balance here, too, because, I never had any problems with anything until I was really about 60. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, ow! Ow. And it was like, how could I possibly be feeling ow? You know, this kind of bruisey, painful stuff. And I do use bioidentical, very low-dose hormones, but I discovered I had to make a few changes in what I was using internally in my vaginal canal to work with. And now it's okay, but it requires some adjusting over time.
It does, and also adjusting to different ability is difficult because then, of course, it brings into, especially I think for both genders, they have different performance anxieties.
Yes.
I know about one couple for whom divorce is not an option. They're both in their early 60s, but the gentleman has MS. And once he was no longer able to make love in the way that he recognizes lovemaking, he completely cut off intimacy with his wife. He wasn't interested in finding other ways to do it, different ways to get to the same place. He was so in grief and mourning over the loss of his vitality and what he considered his masculine identity that he didn't want anything to do with it. And for 10 years, they had no intimacy. And then the wife started seeing a friend of mine, a male friend who lives in the Midwest area. And so now it is a weird kind of open. The husband knows about the wife's partner. They sometimes have dinner together. There's no cohabitation. There's no group anything. My friend doesn't go to family functions or anything like that, although their adult children do know. And so they've made, so the wife gets her intimacy needs met and the romance. The husband has a caretaker and his partner 40 years that is with him. And my friend has a passionate and happy girlfriend whenever they can find time to spend a weekend together. And so I feel bad that he was unable to expand his notion of sensuality to include his new changes in ability. But I'm happy that he was able to understand that it wasn't fair to her that he had just done this. And so when the opportunity came up, they have now, after over the course of 2.5 years, cobbled together something that works for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But our bodies do change as we get older. I think the desire doesn't go away, but, you know, my rotator cuff, your hip replacement, that's going to change, you know, some things that we can do, right? It's going to offer certain things that we can do. My knee replacement, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, we hope that doesn't have to happen. I think if people keep their hormones balanced and they keep active, they may not have that. But But it is the case that because people are worried about doing something wrong, it's sometimes scary to be experimental. But there are lots of things to do physically without having a classic sort of, you know, you're supposed to do it this way. You know,
oh,
there's a
so
whole
much.
Bunch of stuff that can be done. And people can still be wonderfully intimate. In fact, you know, one thing I discovered, which is, again, revealing probably too much information for my audience, but is that, you know, that when you have sex with more than one partner, this is, I am monogamous, but when I wasn't,
right.
It wasn't married.
When you were 30, you know, you were 31.
Yeah, and 40. And So the point being that you have these experiences, and what I learned from doing it, which I think was valuable, is that it has to be warm and friendly and intimate. Even
yes.
if it's not leading to a long-term relationship, it has to be intimate for it to be satisfying and pleasurable.
And worthwhile. I think one of the things when the people involved understand that we understand sex is this: I will fall on my back, and at some point you'll get on top of me, and we'll move around a bit, and then something will happen, and that's sex. And so within that, it may be physically with contact, but you can certainly be emotionally disengaged with conventional sexual intercourse. I mean, there's no question that most people who are listening at some point have been physically in the room and mentally anywhere else but where they are. So when we are deprived through disability or illness of the quote-unquote normal channels of sexual interaction, i.e. in our culture, heterosexual intercourse, then we're left with actually discussing what we want to do. And we have to make our plan today and play by it today and be presently aware in the room. There's what I would like to happen, what used to happen, and what can happen. And so we actually have to discuss it. So even without intercourse, something can be more intimate and more scary and more revealing because we have to be present, because we cannot rely on the way things always used to happen. And then I can say, yes, we had sex, whatever that means. I actually had an experience. And there's so much you can do with a partner that does not involve intercourse or anything that could remotely be considered unsafe. And the safer you try to make something physically, the more fraught it can be emotionally. Because sex is never 100% safe. Because even if it's physically safe, barriers and all that, you're still emotionally vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
hopefully. And
yeah.
even a one-night stand is still a relationship. It's a short one, but it is a relationship. So if we're having sexual interaction that are healthy for us as individuals, we're not acting out self-harming feelings, or we're not acting out of lack of awareness or lack of presence with ourselves. I think all of us have had sex that we regretted later, not because it was bad, but because we realized we were having it for unhealthy reasons. And so as we get older, hopefully we will have less and less sex for unhealthy reasons and more interactions coming from healthy places. And those look like all kinds of things, because then I get to talk to you today. Where are you at? What are you hoping to get out of this? How are you?
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Yeah. Well, and also I think it's a blessing that young people are reexamining gender roles now.
Yeah.
I mean,
it gives
everybody else a kind of it's kind of a relief, you know, because you know, when young women are growing up and they're becoming aware of how strong they are, sometimes physically, like you know, I was a bodybuilder, right? So
right, you
and,
were.
In fact,
yeah.
trained you for a while,
mm-hmm.
If that's okay to say. I've always been very physically strong, and I have issues about. I want to be physically strong. But, you know, there were always issues that came up about how I was perceived because of that. And I had, you know, how I seem, you know, maybe I wasn't, fluffy enough, or maybe I didn't seem to be enough of a breeder or something.
Right.
'Cause I'm not a breeder. So,
right. no,
so,
no,
so
no.
then you just, you know, just having this movement of young people who are reexamining all of these gender roles and playing with them and relaxing with them is such a relief. And then, of course, having a book like yours, it fills in the gaps of, well, what do you do then? You know, you do tell us what do you do then, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I, you know, my job, you know, my job, besides any personal thing I get out of it, is I'm also a nurse first. And our culture, sexuality is sick, and sick people need a nurse's care.
what
what is nursing? Nursing involves role modeling, patient education, and advocacy. And so I speak about sexuality because many people cannot speak about it. They are, for whatever reason, they cannot speak out about it. And I'm here to speak for people who can't speak for themselves. And also to show a little compassion. You know, people think, oh, sex, you don't need sex. You know, you can go your whole life not, quote unquote, have sex and you can be fine. But the people are suffering around sexuality and intimacy, and people, when they're suffering, they need compassion. And to have compassion for a particular thing, one needs to be very centered about it oneself. And so my job is not, if you're talking about consenting adults, my job is not to judge, but my job is to help people find a way to a peaceful inner self about it. Because when we can stop beating ourselves up around our desires, we stop maybe hurting our bodies through drugs and alcohol, or hurting our spirits through inappropriate relationships, or hurting our minds through internalized shame and guilt.
Well, and maybe hurting other people because of all of that.
Exactly. And certainly, you know, when I was still younger and stupider, I was hurting, and I was hurting other people. We're all hurting each other because we're all wandering around with various parts stuck in anatomy abysses, you know, and just not knowing what to do. So helping to alleviate suffering is really important to me in my work and why I do what I do, besides my own jollies, which I will admit that I have gotten many of in my line of work. The biggest satisfaction I get is offering compassion to people who are suffering in this area, because it's very, very real, and I see it, and you see it, and everybody knows people who suffer in this area. And if I can help a person put the light on, flip the switch and go, oh, I don't have to do that anymore, I'm really thrilled to do that, because I want people to suffer less. Because it's I'm a Pisces. I don't like to see people suffer.
Well, you're a bodhisattva is what you are.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Yeah. That's quite a compliment.
Yeah. Well, it is true. I think that when you cut yourself off, or maybe not even consciously, maybe it happens over time without you even realizing it's happening. But when you cut yourself off from sexuality, I think it cuts off a whole section of play and vitality, which is, I believe, essential for fullness in life. You know, it's the child in us. In fact, you know, I think there's too much made of some of the things that happen between children. I think I saw something in the news where
I'm completely
unbelievable. I actually played doctor with a very famous person I won't say the name of when I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We ran around, we got naked, and we screamed and banged our pieces together and
stuff
like that. And it was years later that I found out who that person grew up to be, a very famous musician. But
funny.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you privately later. But
yeah.
So you know, it's very important to maintain that sense of not having shame. I mean, the other joke, you know, is we're both primarily raised by Jewish parents mostly, and the joke is that Christians are guilty about sex and Jews are guilty about everything else, not about sex. So that I didn't have that dark cloud of, you know, thing.
It's true. We're never threatened with hell or damnation.
No.
Or that.
No.
Other kinds of guilty. We are guilty about everything else, certainly. But
everything.
I do feel grateful that whatever my parents did or did not do in my training, I never feared that my essential soul was somehow evil or
in
wrong.
In danger, yes.
And that was a real blessing, you know, because I can spend the rest of my life in therapy about everything else that they may have helped me with. But, yes, that's really important. And what I say in the book, sex is grown-up play.
Yes.
We get to giggle and laugh and feel silly and crazy and, oh, my gosh, I can't believe you did that. you know, and play with finger paints or whatever.
And that
the idea of exploration and discovery and play is really important, especially in, I think, long-term relationships when intimacy can sometimes get bogged down or people can settle into ruts. And then, which leads to resentment, which leads to separation, which leads to all kinds of things. So always finding something new to do together, that you both want to do, but something new. And it doesn't even have to be in the bedroom. If you do something new together outside the bedroom, that will spark up the dopamine and the serotonin and make for more fun later.
Happy chemicals. Yeah.
Happy chemicals, the happy brain chemicals that we can all create in ourselves. Mm-hmm. And sex is good that way because it is a source of vitality. It is a source mm-hmm. of the well of creativity. And that's why it's better to be happily alone than unhappily with somebody else. I learned that very much the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
But first, we have to be alone with ourselves. And so when we are dancing with another person, there's what am I bringing to the table? I'm bringing me and my life and my experience and my issues and my healing. And what are they bringing to it? And I always say that, if you're talking about male-female sexual activity, it does well if the woman brings to the table an ability to be orgasmic.
Next topic. Go ahead.
A woman, it's helpful if she can reliably give herself an orgasm before she starts looking for other partners, because no one gives us an orgasm. I only facilitate my partner finding their orgasm. I cannot give anybody anything, and they can't give it to me. And then a male partner is well advised to, with his private pleasure practice, to be able to stay in the pleasure zone for at least 20 minutes fully engaged, not thinking about baseball statistics, not thinking about dead puppies, but actually being able to withstand pleasure for 20 to 40 minutes without losing his cool. That's very hard for people to do because when we confront ourselves with consensual, safe pleasure, then we get to look at our reaction to it. And then in that reaction to pleasure, we discover everything we've ever been taught about this, all the beliefs that we hold, all the attitudes we bring to it, all the assumptions that we think are true. When we realize, wow, I have a hard time staying being in a pleasure moment without taking myself out of it, stopping the behavior, mm-hmm. taking it out mentally.
Mm-hmm.
So cultivating pleasure as a physical act alone in a room and becoming okay with it is really vitally important to be not just being happier in the world, but being a better partner, a more engaged partner.
Well, it requires, people often feel pressure about having an orgasm, which is why people fake it.
I know.
Shamed by that,
yeah.
too. And I found that what I discovered was I had a very, very patient partner who positioned me and then didn't move, and
happened. Because that partner had done his homework
yes.
and knew how to hang
yes,
around
yes.
in that zone without
yes.
having to move a lot.
But the point is that it requires some patience, both with
yes.
yourself and with your partner, too. And the other thing that's tricky about it is that here we get back to this thing of being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Because an orgasm requires a certain type of surrender.
Yes.
And some people have trouble with that. They're frightened.
Oh, I wouldn't know anything about that.
No? Okay. All right, then. You have to be able to let go, and you have to feel safe to do that. And so it's not going to, you can't beat yourself up if it doesn't. You can still have, like, nice, lovely little feelings without going all the way over the top. And you have to respect that that's what you were able to do at that moment. You can't give yourself, bang your head about not being able to do it.
Also, you have to get, there's no ego involved. I started having much better experiences when I let go of my ego.
Yes.
If I really value my partner's pleasure, then what they need, consenting adults, what they need to get off is fine with me.
Yes.
And so I'm here as a handmaiden to pleasure, and I know that it's, I can't give it to them, they can't give it to me, but I can help create a safe place and have patience and no ego.
Right.
So if my partner, quote-unquote, can't have an orgasm, that it really isn't on me. It's not my job.
That's right.
And if we can let go, Debbie, so-and-so really wasn't very good. He didn't give me an orgasm.
Yeah,
Well, that's not his job, darling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your job is to know what you need and to say, hey, try this, hold this, stroke
right.
this, whisper in my ear,
yes.
Nibble my earlobe.
Yes,
whatever.
I have to close the show down.
Okay, well, thank you so
I have to
much.
Do it really fast. Nina Hartley, what a pleasure you are. Nina Hartley, author of Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex. Thank you again so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for newer extended access to our 500 archive shows. Choose a download or a new library card feature. You can hear a full hour version of this show. Also find information about our practice and our book, and everything is at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.